Case for argument, United States v. Price. Ms. Riley. Yes, Ms. Riley.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Nancy Riley, Counsel for Defendant Appellant Benjamin C. Price. Price is appealing his conviction and sentence of over 20 years for being a felon in possession of a firearm. From the moment the police entered the alley the night of his arrest to sentencing, these proceedings were riddled with errors, each of which warrant reversal in and of itself, but when taken together, the cumulative effect of these errors served to deny Price a fair trial. Price is asking this court to vacate his conviction or, in the alternative, reverse and remand for either a new trial or a new sentence. Today, I will address three issues. First, the second trial in this case never should have occurred, and it was a violation of Price's Fifth Amendment right. Second, under United States v. Cunningham and United States v. Miranda, the district court's...
I don't understand. He wanted a new trial. How can he use his desire for a new trial to lever his way into double jeopardy?
Actually, Your Honor, what he wanted was a new attorney and was forced into consenting to a mistrial.
Yeah, but the trial has started, and so what are you going to do, hold the jury sitting there for a week while a new lawyer gets up to speed?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's
exactly the option
that the government provided to the district court. The government
but why was
on
the
its
district
own
district court compelled to accept that? The district court gives Mr. Price several alternatives. He can proceed pro se, he can continue with Mr. Foley, he can consent to a mistrial. But to put it mildly, Mr. Price has been a difficult litigant, and he's already been through a few lawyers by the time we get to this point. The judge is trying to manage the process, and you're saying that the judge couldn't give that menu of options to Mr. Price because he had to throw in one more option, which is to put everything on hold for a couple of weeks. And I don't see why that makes Mr. Price's decision to agree to the mistrial and start everything all over again coerced. That's where I'm having problems with that.
Your Honor, where the coercion occurs is that the district court forces Price to choose between his Fifth and his Sixth Amendment rights.
He gives him the option of staying with Foley. He gives him the option of going pro se. He's gone pro se for a while. Magistrate Judge Rodovich has gone through the whole litany that you have to go through when somebody wants to exercise his Faretta rights. Mr. Price can't make up his mind what he wants to do.
But, Your Honor, when the district court states, after the jury has been impaneled, that a total breakdown of communication has occurred between Foley and Price, at that point, Price is being denied his Sixth Amendment right to a counsel. At that point, the judge has specifically acknowledged, he's held, that Price is being denied his right to effective assistance of counsel.
You're not giving any weight to considerations on the other side.
It's
awkward to send the jury home for 2 weeks and then come back again.
Given, Your Honor, that is possibly awkward, it was an option presented by the government on its own stead.
It wasn't a good option.
But it was a better option than either forcing him to proceed with his current counsel, counsel that the district court itself had acknowledged was legally deficient.
Well, I wouldn't quite put it that way. I think what the district court said was that Mr. Foley was an outstanding criminal lawyer who had been doing an excellent job for Mr. Price, and Mr. Price, for whatever reason, decided to sit there during the jury selection process and tune out. And so the district judge was willing to say, okay, I think this relationship has fallen apart, but he was ready to put Foley there in the position of backup counsel had the trial gone forward with Mr. Price pro se.
Respectfully, Your Honor, when he says that a total breakdown in communication has occurred, that is the standard to be met.
Why did it occur?
It occurred acknowledged on both sides. Price had wanted...
Why did it occur, I'm asking you?
Price had wanted certain things done, motions filed, time with his attorney.
Were they reasonable demands?
Yes, Your Honor, I think it's a reasonable demand to ask that your attorney spend time with you, that it address...
Spend how much time with you?
enough so that you can, with him, mount a defense. I don't know how many.
So you're handing these people a formula for completely disrupting the trial process. Make ridiculous demands on a lawyer, appointed lawyer, then say there's a breakdown. Do this in the middle of the. What if it's happened in the middle of the trial? It'd make no difference from your standpoint, I take it. Right? Suppose a long trial. It's been going on for weeks. And then all of a sudden the Price announces, no, I can't get along with my lawyer. I need another lawyer. So now do you interrupt the trial for several weeks to enable him to find a new lawyer and communicate with a lawyer and get up to speed with a lawyer? Then the trial resumes. Is that your idea?
No, Your Honor, but in this case,
no,
that's
what
not
do you mean,
what
no?
Because that's not what occurred in this case.
Of course it didn't occur. What I'm asking you a hypothetical question.
That if Price had merely said that there was personality issues?
I was very explicit. The trial has been going on for weeks. Now Price says, our relationship is broken down, the lawyer won't do what I want, I want a new lawyer. And if a new lawyer is appointed, it takes several weeks to find the lawyer and for the lawyer to get up to speed. So is the judge obligated in that case, as you believe is true in this case, to interrupt the trial, send the jury home, and then resume, you know, 3 or 4 weeks later when he has a new lawyer? Is that your proposition?
If what had happened met the standard.
Don't say if. You answer my question.
What you're articulating.
Don't tell me what I'm articulating. You say yes or no.
No, because in that case, it would not have met the standard of denial of effective assistance of counsel.
Why not?
Jurisprudence
Why
is
not?
Clear that.
Why not? Their relationship is broken down.
Well, if their relationship is broken down, yes. If it meets the standard articulated in the jurisprudence.
Okay, so suppose it meets the standard. Trial is interrupted. Trial resumes after a month, goes on for another few days, then there's another breakdown. And Price says, I need a new lawyer. Our relationship is broken down. So you have another interruption, you have another month. And according to you, as long as it was a genuine breakdown in the relationship, yeah, that's the only thing the judge can do.
Price is, under the Constitution, guaranteed a right to assistance
of
counsel.
That's using the Constitution to, you know, generate an absurd result.
The district court also has the ability to manage its own call. And if that was the case where there was multiple issues where Price had again and again at trial requested new counsel during trial, then at some point, yes, the district court would
what
be able
point
to stop
is that?
It.
The third time, the fourth time, the 20th time?
That would be in the discretion of the district court, Your Honor. However, that's not the case here.
But I think it is precisely the case here, because if you look at the docket sheet here, which was enormous, Judge Simon had been putting up with Price for quite a long time, and he thought that when that particular breakdown happened, that moment had been reached. You know, there'd been Mr. Martin, there'd been, you know, earlier lawyers, and Judge Simon thought, you know, let's just make a decision. Had Price said, I would like to proceed pro se with backup counsel, he could have done that. He could have continued the trial. He could have continued with Mr. Foley. But in fact, he opted for a new start, which is actually what he wants now, too, interestingly enough. You know, so I guess, you know, in part, one of your backup arguments, I guess if he wins on double jeopardy, that's not what would happen, but you've got other arguments as well that might lead to yet another trial.
Yes, Your Honors, and what we're saying here, though, is the district court forced him to exchange his Fifth for Sixth Amendment rights, and when making this decision, he was not represented by counsel, and he was forced to make a critical decision of whether or not to waive his Fifth Amendment rights. He was utterly confused by this. The record shows that at least four times he requested clarification, and this came under extreme compulsion and time pressure, and therefore his consent was not meaningful. This brings me to my second point, which is that under United States versus Cunningham and United States versus Miranda, that the district court must take into consideration non-frivolous issues when it is comprising its sentence. In this case, there is absolutely no evidence that the district court considered Price's history of substance abuse and depression. The pre-sentence investigation report detailed that Price had been starting to use alcohol in the fifth grade, and that he had extreme history of substance abuse, that most of his or many of his convictions stemmed from that issue, that Price had tried to make rehabilitative efforts, and that in the 6 years before the arrest, although he was still struggling with substance abuse, he was, other than that, a law-abiding citizen.
But, you know, the district court says that he's read the pre-sentence report. The pre-sentence report goes through this, and on top of that, the court does order Price to participate in a drug treatment program, which suggests to me that he realized that drugs were somewhere in the picture. We don't require district courts to have lengthy discussions on everything.
No, Your Honor, but under this court's holding in United States versus Miranda, which was just decided on October 26, 2007, citing the Cunningham decision.
Yeah, but look at his criminal record, right? That's what struck the judge.
Respectfully, yes, it did. But then the district court...
You are working on your 10th criminal conviction?
Yes, and it...
You have 19 other arrests?
But the district court focuses on...
Why wouldn't it be reasonable to interpret this to mean that he believed that the depression, the drug addictions are dominated by this extraordinary criminal record? Which is a perfectly reasonable conclusion. You're going to let a person like this out early, right?
Respectfully, Your Honor, these factors mitigated against a harsh sentence to some extent.
It's not clear they mitigate. Not clear that drug addiction mitigates.
But at least, Your Honor, they should have been taken into consideration, and Price should have the assurance that they were. There is absolutely no...
Why do you think drug addiction mitigates guilt?
Your Honor, I don't think it mitigates guilt. If I said that, I misspoke.
No, it's my mistake.
Why should you have a shorter sentence, I think, is the question. Yeah. Why, if you're a drug addict, should you have a 200-month sentence instead of a 250-month sentence?
What we're asking is that...
But that's what you're asking.
We're asking that the district court had considered two things. That his history of substance abuse had... I see that my time is...
You're in your rebuttal time.
Can I finish this?
Yes, please.
Okay. What we're asking is that when it's considering all the factors, that the district court had looked at its history of substance abuse...
What would you say, if you were arguing to the judge, what would you say about his history of drug abuse that would be a sufficiently good argument that the judge really ought to discuss it?
That the district court... as we can see from the record, took into consideration his history of...
You're not listening to me. What would you say to the judge, not to us, what would you say to the judge in mitigation of punishment with regard to his history of drug abuse?
I would say that you are considering his criminal history, much of which stems at least part... While it doesn't excuse, helps to explain... much of his criminal history, and that you are making an issue of the fact that Price has failed to conform himself with the law. However, this record also shows that in the past 6 years, he has taken extreme steps to begin that process. He was not in trouble for the 6 years leading up to the arrest, and after the arrest, he specifically left Gary, took himself out of that situation, went to Florida, where he enrolled in a drug treatment program, a year program that he successfully completed, and he was working there following that, and that program was willing to vouch for Mr. Price during the sentencing hearing. This shows that although, yes, we know that he has a long criminal history, but he had turned a corner and is really attempting to make something of his life. These issues should have been considered by the district court. There is no evidence that they were at all, no evidence in the record, and Mr. Price is faced with a 20-year sentence, and he should have some assurance that the district court took these factors into consideration.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ms. Riley. Mr. Lanter?
Thank you. May it please the Court, Dean Lander representing the United States in this matter. To address the sentencing issue first, I think it's important to understand that Mr. Price's counsel at sentencing, who was Mr. Milner, his fourth attorney in the case, did not bring up, and there was no drawing to the judge's attention, his drug abuse or his drug addiction in the past. Mr. Milner asked for a reduced sentence on the basis of Mr. Price's efforts to rehabilitate himself after he had already been incarcerated prior to trial. Mr. Milner brought to the judge's attention certain courses that Mr. Price had taken, and the judge addressed the things that were brought to the attention of him by the defense counsel.
But he didn't mention, did he, this drug program that he took in Florida?
The defense counsel? No, he did not, Your Honor.
I thought you just said that the defense counsel did draw the judge's attention to efforts that Price had made to rehabilitate himself.
What had happened in this case is after the crime occurred, Mr. Price went to Florida and was involved in a drug rehabilitation clinic down there. After that, he's arrested in Florida on the charge and brought back to Hammond, Indiana. Once he's in custody awaiting trial, he enrolls in and completes certain courses at the MCC in Chicago.
Oh, I see. So that's what the lawyer mentioned, but not the Florida trip?
That's correct. Mr. Milner pointed the judge's attention to Mr. Price's efforts after he'd been arrested on this charge, while he's awaiting, right, while he's in custody, awaiting trial. And the judge addressed those. The district court indicated that those efforts were counterweighed by the fact that he felt the nature and circumstances of the offense, Mr. Price being a felon possessing a firearm, was a very dangerous offense. And despite his efforts at rehabilitation at the MCC taking these courses, Price's long criminal history showed that the 250-month sentence was a fair and reasonable sentence under all the circumstances. It's important to note that the guideline range was 235 to 293 months. Judge Simon, after all of these proceedings, sentenced Price to within the lower third of the guideline range. So he did not even give him anywhere near the maximum of the guideline range, but tried to craft a sentence based on his study of the pre-sentence report, all the arguments made to them by the parties, and came up with a sentence of 250 months, still in the lower end of the guideline range for this crime.
Mr. Price's allocution at sentencing didn't actually bespeak a person on the road to rehabilitation, if that's the claim. He was making accusations against his various attorneys and against the court and against the system and so forth.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I believe that the district court throughout these proceedings showed extraordinary patience and extraordinary judgment in attempting to give Mr. Price the benefit of the doubt. Even with the first trial, prior to that trial beginning, the court held two separate hearings on Mr. Price's relationship with Mr. Foley, which was his second attorney in the case. He'd originally had Mr. Martin. He dismissed him, went pro se, then had Mr. Foley. The district court repeatedly indicated that he did not believe there was a breakdown in communication, repeatedly praised Mr. Foley's efforts, and took a long, hard look in two separate hearings. Only after the jury was sworn in, when Mr. Price and Mr. Foley indicate that Price's position is, I'm not communicating with anybody, I'm not stipulating to anything, I'm done with these proceedings, had the judge said there's been a total breakdown in communication. At that point, however, that was a breakdown in communication caused entirely by Mr. Price. And it's the government's position that a defendant cannot just decide at a particular point in the case when he doesn't feel like things are going his way to absent himself from the proceedings and basically declare, I'm gonna push the panic button or the emergency button that we're having a breakdown in communication to try to take advantage of the system.
Is that it?
Unless the court has any other questions, the government will stand on its brief.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Leonard. Mr. Riley, how much time does she have? 1 minute? Yeah.
First, Your Honors, while Price may have been a difficult defendant, he still had the right to a fair trial. Second, the standard articulated in this court in United States v. Miranda is that when a district court gives little or no attention to the defendant's principal argument, when that argument was not so weak as not to merit discussion, we cannot have confidence that the judge adequately considered Section 3553A factors. And while Price's history of substance abuse and his attempts to comport himself with the law, those were in the pre-sentence investigation report, there is no indication in the record that the judge considered any of them.
Does the judge have to make an independent study of the pre-sentence report, or can he rely on the defendant's lawyer to draw his attention to any mitigating circumstances revealed by the report?
Your Honor, the district court is under an obligation to study the pre-sentence investigation report, and in this case he said he did.
The judge only has to discuss the 3553A factors that are drawn to his attention by the lawyer for the defendant. Now, there could be something just jumped out at you in the pre-sentence report that the judge should take account of, but ordinarily we don't require that.
Well, Your Honors, in this case, I would submit that Price should not be penalized because his counsel at the time did not take enough time to thoroughly read this report and present the most favorable and principal arguments regarding why 3553A counseled against a guideline sentence. Price is asking this court to vacate his conviction or, in the alternative, to reverse and remand for a new trial and a new sentence. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.